How do you live your life like tomorrow matters? Perhaps you're already growing food, consuming less, connecting with your community. Perhaps you're already thinking hard, keen to see the world a little slower, greener, healthier. But where to begin?
Here on the Future Setting Podcast, we dig deep into the hearts and minds of blissfully normal people doing bloody amazing things, unearthing their moments of contradiction, their hopes and fears for the future, and what galvanizes them to action, in the name of inspiring all of us to do a little more in shaping a better future today. I'm Katie.
And I'm Jade, and this is Future Steady.
Welcome to the second season of Future Steading. Woo, yeah, all right, woo, yeah. Okay. After 2 weeks of podcastlessness, we're happier than ever to be back and extremely grateful to be hanging out in your ears. For today's episode, we sought out one of the grooviest, most joyful, and radically inspiring women around, Hannah Maloney from Good Life Permaculture. What she has to share in this next hour is pure gold, so we're just going to jump right in. Thanks so much to Hannah Maloney for chatting with us today.
So I might get the pronunciation of this right, but you're in Muwinina?
Muwinina.
Muwinina in Taz. So you're in Hobart.
Yeah.
And I reckon the vast majority of people that are listening to us will know who you are. But just in case, especially given that we've now seen your beautiful face on Gardening Australia and, you know, you've got an incredible following via Instagram. But for those who don't, you are the founder of Good Life Permaculture. And you do, as part of all of that, design, obviously, lots and lots of teaching. And you actually live, breathe, think, heartbeat of permaculture. And also your backstory is that you're a committed advocate for climate action and First Nations justice. And I know we often come across people who kind of bolt a number of different causes or deep-seated beliefs together, but I would love as we go today to chat with you about both of those things in addition to your permaculture background. But you're about to start a book.
Oh, yeah, I am. Gosh, it's so huge, Jade. And also, like, what a luxury to be able to do something like that. And I know you're doing it as well.
I had to. That is a luxury. You're right. Yeah. It's a perfect example, a perfect word for it.
It is such luxury. And my slight sound of despondence.
You're only at the beginning. So I look forward to chatting with you at the very end.
Gosh, just that sifting through thoughts, finding time for deep thinking is always a challenge. And that has to happen between the hours of 4 a.m. and 7 a.m. for me at the moment. So just trying to do it justice around a really beautifully busy life is my challenge. And then trying to make the most of the opportunity so that it can deliver something that is worthwhile now, but also hopefully forever. So yeah, what a tricky beast to navigate.
Yeah, and also then whether you like it or not, the ego kind of speaks to you and says, you're putting your name to this in a very public realm. So you want it to do your thought process justice while still resonating with people who pick it up and be intrigued by it, while being timely for now, as you say, but also having longevity in its words.
Yeah, like because I we have so many books in the world, which I adore. Why do we need more? And I think it's like we always need that relevant storytelling responding to times of any time that you happen to be in. And I really think, we're in a really unique time. We all know that, whatever. I think it's a time that we get to hear from different voices that maybe we hadn't heard from a lot in recent years and decades. And I think that's really interesting. So like more women writing, more First Nations people writing, and more, not that we haven't always, but more people ready to read and listen.
And really hear.
Yeah, yes, like deep listening.
Yeah. And possibly take action from what they've heard.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Now, you don't navigate life on your own, though. You're a really big community advocate and you're with your partner and your little girl It's Frida, isn't it?
That's right, yeah.
And then I know you've got a really big, strong, real, robust network down there, but also on the mainland as well. Can you talk to us a bit about how you've built your community?
Sure. So as a young adult, 20 years ago, we didn't really have the internet.
No. Back in the olden days.
And I remember I grew up in Brisbane, and I left Brisbane when I was 18 because we had a fantastic community growing up, really progressive, really interesting, really multicultural. And I started hearing, and I grew up in a political household, so I was quite, paying attention to stuff. Mm-hmm. And then, we'd hear things about, or in the news and just through networks about things called a detention centre opening up in in South Australia, and horrifying treatment of our forests in Tasmania and Victoria and other places. And I just went, I don't think that mainstream media is actually telling us the whole story.
Mm. Are you quite young when you decided that?
Oh, yeah. Like, I reckon probably 14.
Wow.
And because I grew up in quite a progressive community, I was hearing from a lot of activists, like their firsthand experience. So I knew that there was more sides to the story. Mm. But it was really hard to get access to that story. So I actively physically travelled across Australia for quite a long time to go to places like Woomera Detention Centre, which has since closed, but to see, to witness it, I guess, and to learn and understand, have a really deep learning curve and quite a sad learning curve about our political system in Australia, at this horrifying humanitarian environmental laws and policies that uphold them. So I had maybe a 3-year just deep dive into the atrocities of humanity.
Wow, and you were young. So imagine putting all of that complexity into a really young, vulnerable mind. It would have been a really confronting period, I imagine.
Yeah, like I also had the most wonderful time, just gorgeous. I found my people along the way. I just landed on my feet amongst all the atrocities. I went, oh, this is what I do for my life. This is where we are needed, and I could see how I could be useful. And what an amazing thing for a human to feel, like to go, I have purpose. And and then all of a sudden everything makes sense. Everything is crystal clear, and you can just go for it. And that is amazing, yeah.
Yeah, so you've had that clarity for a very long time.
Yeah, and I realise how lucky I am, because a lot of people don't have that, and I don't necessarily think everybody has to, by the way. I know I have some very dear friends who are happily just gorgeously muddling along and doing a great job of it.
Yeah, and really happy, really content.
Really stoked. but I'm really mindful that I have really clear focus, and people say that to me, when did it come? And I came very young, and it's been a really big guiding point for me, I guess. How do you use your energy while you're here? And that hasn't been a hard question for me to answer. Yeah.
So you started pretty actively getting involved in activism for the things that you believed in, and actually I feel like that's And now, though, you are in a position where you're pretty grounded, and the things that you stand for are pretty solid and pretty consistent, and you very publicly put that into an open space for discussion and for debate. But you've sort of been on this path where you started with very strong activism, and now you've kind of evolved that to look through different lenses and to deliver that activism in a slightly different way. And I feel like that's a really common path for lots of people, and I guess maybe in this permaculture space that's pretty common. Do you feel like that's a common theme in your world too, where you've watched people go from kind of active activism to active kind of solidification of whatever it is that they're putting their energy into?
Yeah, and I think it's a really natural progression. Mm. Frontline activism is incredibly confronting and horrifyingly draining, for me at least. Mm-hmm. And while I really had a good crack at it, I burnt out more than once, more than twice, and I went, oh, this cycle of confrontation, exhaustion, and burnout is going to keep happening. I just identified that quite quickly. And also it's a really negative space. And that's not a criticism. That I want to be very clear about that. We need frontline activists. They are some of our biggest heroes. I don't think all of us are best utilised in that space, though. We have our different strengths. Find your strength and go hard there. So for me, after quite a few years of frontline activism, I actually just took a step back and did some, worked really hard on organic permaculture farms. But I just had a little break from activism. I went, I just need to pause and reflect here. And that's, by that time I'd already done quite a lot of work on permaculture farms. I was really quite aware of that. But I finally did what they call a permaculture design course in my early 20s. And I thought I'd already knew everything about permaculture. But that course really helped me join the dots between environmental, social, First Nations, like everything basically. They joined the dots between everything.
Yeah. The complexity suddenly started to clarify a little.
Yeah. And I went, and the penny dropped. And I went, I can be an activist forever if I switch over to something like permaculture, which for me was a really natural framework for me to fall into. And I can be a positive activist for the rest of my life, nourishing myself in the process and my community, ensuring I can just never burn out. That is the key thing for me. It's a really big thing. Don't burn out.
Because it doesn't actually serve anybody then.
No. And I don't want to get to the point where, when I was young, I was like, I don't want to turn 30 or 40 or whatever and go, now I'm going to go get a real job and settle down. This is my real job.
This is my life. I am a radical homemaker, and through that I will influence the world.
Yeah, forever. And I had to find the way where I could be that forever. And that's, it's an ever-evolving thing, but I feel like it's pretty good.
Hannah, you mentioned that you're able to think between 4 and 7 a.m. each day.
Yeah.
Can you paint a picture of what your days look like in South Hobart there?
Yeah, sure thing. Well, yeah, I get up at 4 or 5 a.m. every morning, and it's because the house is really quiet, which is really great. And I will do a range of things. So first of all, I will exercise. Exercise is a really huge part of my mental and physical health. And so I do that, and then I will have 2 to 3 hours in our little office in the garden where I will work on whatever needs my freshest brain cells for, because my brain is crystal clear at that time of the day, whereas by 5 p.m. it's a little bit fuzzy. And that's just how it's always been my whole life. I'm a morning person. So currently it's when I write my book, or I might work on a landscape design for a client, whatever is most pressing, I put my energy there. And then at around 7 a.m. or 7:30, I'll come back into the house and hug my family. And then I always have to go and milk my goats. I have 2 milking goats, and tend to the other animals, which are chooks and ducks as well. So that's a really clear morning pattern for me every day. And the goats are the best.
They're real characters, I bet.
Yeah. And people say, it must be really hard because you have to do it every day and, it's early and all the things. I'm like, I love it.
Yeah. It's a real full stop in your morning, or an exclamation mark in your morning.
Yeah. It's the start of the day. I get to cuddle these beautiful creatures. We know each other quite well now, and that I love that.
I bet there's a real intimacy there, is there?
Yeah, 100%. Like, my goats are really gorgeous. One's quite calm, one's a bit more frisky. They're both absolutely delightful. They really know you. Like, they're so intelligent, as most people know about goats, but they really, we just have a good time together.
Did you ever imagine you would say that sentence when you were 12?
Yeah. I should have actually. Yeah.
And so how do the rest of your team, your husband and your, actually, are you guys married? I shouldn't make that assumption.
We are married, yeah, which still surprises me. I never thought I'd get married, but it was such a beautiful, natural way for us to bring our communities together and celebrate, and it was a really creative, fun party. So we really embraced it.
Yeah, and now do you feel like you've got this world, this tribe of people that are around you through thick and thin to kind of be with you forever? They were there on the day that you made that declaration, and now they've kind of got you back for the next part of the journey.
Yeah, it feels really special. Like I underestimated how special it would be. And then for the actual ceremony, which we kind of facilitated ourselves, I was like, oh, this is so deeply, this is written on my soul, this moment. It is so deep. And I had underestimated that. I was like, oh, yeah, let's just have a big party. And I was like, oh, this is that transition into new chapters of life. We don't really do ceremony in our culture, and so I hadn't experienced that, but that was the first time I'd experienced like that really hugely significant moment. Yeah, with hundreds of people watching you, it's like, wow.
Yeah, the greatest of all. And has it led you to realize that with that lack of ceremony or ritual in our world, we're actually missing out, and actually we need to actively put it back into place, and now you do?
Yeah, look, absolutely, 100%. We really miss it. I find I think we all lack it, and I think we all kind of crave it and seek it. Mm-hmm. I also find it incredibly hard to do. Like, it requires a lot of energy and thinking and coordination and organising. Which is, you need to follow up and be really committed on doing. And isn't that sad that it has to be such a outside thing from our day-to-day life and culture? So I wish we could do more of it, those things. But anything we can get is better than nothing.
Yeah, and sometimes those things don't need to be a wedding of 200 people. That daily cup of tea with someone really special in a faraway place. We've got tools now that allow you to send a photograph of yourself having that cup of tea in a special cup with that special friend, and they're doing the same wherever they are in the world. Mm. And, you know, maybe that's all it needs to be, or the celebration of really simple things that happen annually, you know, like birthdays or anniversaries or, you know, death dates or, you know, things that all of us have, and it's just sort of stepping up a little bit more and actively becoming aware of them.
Yeah, and finding connection. I think for people, like, I've got a pretty strong introvert streak for me, and it is sometimes a lot easier not to do any of those things. Mm. Like, oh, no, I'll just be over here.
Only when you need me.
But I'm actively practicing not doing that all the time, because we are so much better for seeking each other out, without a doubt. You never regret that, ever. Yeah.
Hannah, your morning routine sounds so joyful, and it really feels like you're in the groove of life. And someone made this comment to me the other day on Instagram. They messaged and they listened to Future Studying, and they just said, you know, they're doing all this planting and guerrilla gardening, and for the first time in their life they are in the groove, they're in the flow of existence, and they felt for a long time they were kind of on the periphery and just watching, but then having this relationship with their garden and their community and their neighbours has made them feel like they're really in the current. And listening to you speak reminds me of that comment, and I know you do a lot of teaching, and do you find that people, when they start gardening or just getting their hands in the soil or just engaging in any way with their environment, they start to feel more alive?
Mm. Yeah, oh, 100%. And I get that anecdotal feedback from lots of students and friends over the years. And it's a scientifically proven fact now that, you know, put your hands in the dirt, you will feel better. So, look, there's so many benefits. And I think something that you mentioned is that people often feel they're on the periphery, and by getting involved and reconnecting with nature in particular, and then also with other humans and animals, that reconnection is a really rejuvenating, inspiring and motivating force. you quickly start joining dots. You go, oh, yeah, you know, we're all connected. How about that?
Maybe. Know?
Yeah. And like, what if we all kind of looked out for each other and didn't trash stuff all the time? And how would that be? And like, there's an intuitive, natural conversation or feeling you arrive at. And it's not rocket science. It's human nature at its purest. I think we are all naturally that way wired. I think we just live in an incredibly complex system, which distracts us from that every day. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I sometimes make those sweeping generalizations about how we're all so disconnected. And then I wonder, is that really true? Am I just kind of in my bubble here and looking out? But it does seem to be a common theme that people, and I know I've felt this myself, are kind of in an eddy and looking out and really wondering how I'm going to get back into the river. And maybe it is just starting to plant something, or what do you find is a really simple action that starts kind of turning those cogs for people?
Yeah. Look, obviously it depends on your context, where you are and what you happen to be interested in. I don't actually think everyone needs to grow their own food. It's some people are completely uninterested by that. I do think we all need to have a relationship with our natural world, though. And so simple actions might just be going bushwalking or in your local bush or near rivers or oceans, whatever your natural ecosystem happens to be. I think that's a really powerful thing. If you are interested, obviously, in where your food comes from, which, you know, we all should be, really.
it's pretty foundational.
Yeah,
it's pretty. Don't grow it. Know who does and know how they do it.
100%. And but growing food can be as little as having a mint plant in a pot on your balcony to an elaborate vegetable garden or farm system. It doesn't have to be much, though, to reconnect with where your food comes from. And I think it's but what we're trying to, you know, get to is like the values underneath that and the ethics of how we live, and those actions can help reconnect you to that.
Yeah, I often get asked if I could start something, how do I start and where do I start? And my answer is really similar to yours. And another thing that people can do is really accessible to absolutely everybody, but it does take a little bit of commitment from your mind, really, and that's the art of noticing. So that really simple act of maybe setting yourself a task of just observing and noticing the swell of buds on a plant right at your front door, and the smell and the color and the time frame that it takes and the weather that it needs to kind of allow it to evolve. And it can be really, really simple, and it's something that we're not encouraged to do in the world that we live in anymore, where we're bombarded with a million different messages every single day from all sorts of different platforms and angles. But really taking time and discipline to actually observe and notice all of the little tiny gifts that we can be given gives us time to actually, as I'm saying this, I can hear my brother, who we interviewed in series one, saying, that's bullshit. It actually takes a whole lot of effort and energy to genuinely observe and notice. And so there's kind of two sides to that story too. Noticing isn't encouraged because we're full already, but it's also actually really hard to do because it does require active discipline. But, you know, they're those little tiny simple things. What are some of the simple things that you do in your day? We've heard about your gorgeous mornings that kind of bring your husband and Frida along for the ride with those around you as well in your broader community.
Yeah, I guess we have, like, Frida will sometimes come milk the goats with me. She's a great milker already, which is great. Yeah, so I involve her in as much as she is interested in being involved in, which is, you know, varies, which is good. It's an interesting thing because our work and life is so integrated. So our little urban farm essentially is very activated with lots of people coming here and going, and Frida is very involved in that, which we love. Little things we do in our landscape with her in mind is we grow lots more flowers now, which I actually love. Our latest ones that we've grown tulips this year, and they're flowering now, and every single one is a different flower and color, you never know what color it's going to be. And so for the past few weeks, it's just been every morning we go searching for what colour tulips have opened in that day. And it's just, it's really cool. I didn't know I was ever going to love growing tulips, but I love growing tulips.
And it's probably a bit contagious. She probably loves spotting the different pops of colour. So
yeah. It's gorgeous. And then with Anton, he used to work with me quite a lot, and now he and two friends got pretty fired up after our last federal election about the lack of climate action on our horizon. And so they went up and set up a electric car company where they import secondhand electric cars from Japan. And that's quite a huge ambitious national project they're doing now. So Anton and I, we share an office, but we work on separate projects, but they're both angled at the same destination. So the biggest thing that we do for each other is we support each other's work, and we love each other a lot. we have sometimes stressful days or hard days like everybody else, but we have a thing where we can't go to bed until we're in a place of complete love towards each other, which is a really it's a really simple thing. And sometimes, you know, the love is, you know, it's like, yes, I really, really love you, I just need to have some space from you right now. But it's always a place of goodness, and we go, yeah, and that's really important for us. It kind of allows us to close a day where we know that we're in the like a really supported, loved space. Even though we're stretching ourselves and trying to do different things all the time, we've got a really good team family vibe going on. Yeah,
you're in that bell jar together, and the outside world can throw what it likes at you, but you've got this bell jar of protection as a team.
Yeah, that's really, really important to me. Like I can't, I didn't realize how important it was until maybe I didn't always try to do work that was so public, but then I realized that we have to do whatever we can, which to try to have climate justice in our world, try to change politics, the political narrative of our times. We need to do everything we can, which means for me that mostly I'm hugely uncomfortable 99% of the time.
I'm always out on the edge.
Yeah, always outside my comfort zone, and I'm always trying to push it further, which I think we should all be doing. And it's so important to know that I have Anton and little Frida there who've got me, kind of holding me together, you know. Yeah.
Do you have a broader network than that that holds you as well?
I do, yeah, I do. And they're dear friends. They're all similarly working really hard in different ways towards the same countering the climate justice, trying to change our culture of our times to be more progressive, working with First Nations communities, like all working really hard doing critically important work. And we just check in on each other sometimes, and sometimes it's a cup of tea or an email, but it's really good to know that they're there. Just knowing that they're there is really good. And I must say, because we've all been doing it for our whole adult lives, like it's not a new thing for us, but it is, the urgency is increasing. It's heartening how much more open people are towards it. However, it's devastating how much apathy there's also towards those issues. So it's a really, it's a mixed bag of emotions. The key thing is that we're not in it alone. It's very much together. And to have that community where you can, you know, cry with, laugh with, scheme with, and dream up bigger and better ideas with is very, very important.
And celebrate with when you win something.
Of course. Thanks. Yeah, absolutely.
Bring a bit of that in. So it sort of sounds like activism is still a very big part of what you're doing, but you're just doing it in a different way so that you're sustainable and your natural introvertedness can actually be respected and honoured.
Yeah, like I just, and you know, in my ideal world, I'd be doing so much more. And I have plans too. but I think that you just need to work with who you are in the same time as make sure you grow into a more impactful person in every possible way you can. And I can look back on my own adult life and I go, yes, I am evolving. I am trying new and different things and I'm seeing new and different outcomes, which I think are more positive. None of that's very comfortable and it's not easy. So people say, oh, you have such a good life. And I really go, yeah, I love my life. It's a good life. But I also really believe a good life is a pretty hard life. And I don't, it's not a bad thing, but it's you really got to do some really heart and gut wrenching work and really feel a lot of feelings to try to have a good life for everybody, not just you and your little nuclear family over there in the corner. It's really vulnerable work and sticky business and very imperfect. Yeah, super. Yeah, earnest while trying not to be too serious. Like it's you know, I used to be a very dogmatic activist. Not a good idea, by the way.
Just tell us why that's not a good idea. So we would like to understand really where that leads you.
Well, it leads you to not having many friends. you have friends, but they're just you're a very particular group, and you don't talk to anybody else, and everybody's wrong, and you're right. And how come they aren't just all agreeing with you and doing what you say?
The puritanical didn't work, and so yes. Now you've taken that sense of urgency and an acknowledgement of the discomfort and said, okay, we're going to take a different approach.
Yeah, it has to be positive. It has to be inclusive. It has to be for everybody, and you have to find those intersections where we all meet and then go there. And I mentioned it's all very imperfect and there's so much worry about stuffing things up and hurting people and some of those intersections. And I think we still have to go there and be prepared to say sorry and learn and keep going anyway, because we have to be vulnerable. We have to open up and we have to go deeper. We're flapping around, just popping band-aids on everything. It's like that's not adequate. We have to go deeper, rebuild systems, and this is multi-generational work. This is not going to be happening in the next few decades, and it's been going on for many generations before we arrived. This culture-changing work is long, long game work, and so we have to work out we're here for a blip of time. How can we help join the dots for the next people coming so that we can progress things as much as possible? Yeah.
So in two different sentences, and I think this is the quandary that lots of us face, in two different sentences we've heard you say, and pretty well everybody else we've interviewed, that there is this overwhelming sense of urgency. And then in another sentence we've heard you say, but this is a multi-generational long game. I don't know how your head goes, but my head flaps a bit and I sometimes flat spin and think, oh God, there's not enough time and there is so much to do and I need to make it happen kind of yesterday. But if I'm not around to make this a foundation that my children want to engage in, then, you know, the long game starts to suffer, and actually it is a long game. So how do you manage that kind of complexity around urgency and long game?
Yeah, I have quite a lot of anxiety around it. So I do have to name that up. I also, my most successful strategy is to find the joy in the activism and the work that we can do now, even though it's quite, doesn't look great, to be frank. Like the current political and trajectory does not look great for us. However, you need to foster something called radical hope, where, yes, you could go curl up in the ball over there and hope it goes away and cry a lot, or you could go, let's use this fantastic life opportunity we have to counter everything and demonstrate how our world could be different. So use positive activism to show and not just tell how things could be, knowing that they might not happen and being okay with that, or being having a level of peace of that. I feel it's a hard thing to articulate, but you have to try and you have to find the joy in the trying. And a lot of the stuff that we work towards will happen because humans want to survive, and they want their children's children to have a good future. We don't want to you know, we don't want to become extinct. That's not a thing that we actually actively want to do. So I think there will be there is already a transition happening, but that will increase in speed as the urgency increases. I do have a unbridled sense of hope that we can do this when we're ready to actually choose to do it.
Yeah, and when we come together to do it.
Yeah.
Hannah, absolutely. I'd love to ask you a little bit more about A Good Life, which is also your business namesake. And it seems to me that what we consider to be a good life or what we consider successful is pretty much wrapped up in the status quo and perpetuating the status quo in a lot of cases, because success is seen as money, climbing the career ladder, etc. Those are the prevailing beliefs. How do you define success, and how can we redefine success for everyone?
It's a big thing, isn't it? Like, when I was trying to name a business, it's like I just kept coming back to the good life, the concept of good life, because wrapped up in that for me is that concept of enoughness, having enough for your own and family and community to thrive and not just to survive. And that's a really big thing for me. Like, the concept of enoughness is quite, it's a limiting factor. So you don't need to have the big house, the big car, the big everything. You find the joy in the more intangible things, like the relationships, the experiences that you have in life. And it's enough, and it's more than enough, really. We're doing so, we're having a great time. It's a great life. and it's a hard thing. It is a complex thing in our world around success, because so much of it is wrapped up in having a good job, having a good wage, having a good home, and what that looks like to people is usually wrapped up in financial security, and that's. You know, it's a big conversation. Not everybody can have financial security, and especially now with COVID and all the jobs being cut, it's like, how do you still have a good life with huge insecurity wrapped around everything that once was stable? And I think it comes back down to community resilience, which is based on relationships and caring for each other.
And skills, or is that too practical? It's bigger than that.
Yeah, I think skills comes into it, of course. It's heaps of practical stuff that has to come into it. But at the foundation, we just need to connect a bit better and care for our community. And you did see those beautiful outpourings of community in the early stages of COVID down in here in Tassie and all around the country. You saw things all around the world, of course. And that was people come together when they're in hardship, and that's a beautiful thing. And you don't have to always be in moments of, we shouldn't have to always be in moments of stress and anxiety for that to be induced, ideally. Yeah, that'd be nice. Yeah. But then the practical skills, yes. And I think it's, oh gosh. And I'll take you back to when I was a young adult again, when I was trying to work out what to be when I grew up. And there was a moment where, because in our culture we really celebrate academia, and it's just not a natural thing that I'm drawn to, but I deeply appreciate and value in other people. I had a conversation with somebody at the time about being useful for our future in my lifetime. How can I be most useful? And we had a bit of a chat about, what do people need? We need shelter, we need food, education, all those basics. And I landed on food as a practical skill that I could foster, because we always need to eat. And so as a result, I'm very good at growing food and designing landscapes to be regenerative on small and large scales. It's a really useful skill. But then I also went and trained in community cultural development, because I knew people were critical to looking after our environment. We can't do it without people cooperating. So I think skills are essential, and working out what skills that you learn, it could be more academic or more hands-on, but I think there has to be that collaboration between the both as much as possible. Yeah.
It's interesting that you take that approach as a self-confessed introvert. So I watched you work in that very delicate space of building community and communicating, at a deep winter. We all came down and spent a couple of days in your beautiful town of Signet. And, you know, it was a couple of hundred people in lots of coats because it was the middle of winter. Mm. And you stood at the front of us and navigated your way through some big personalities, through some complex ideology. And you took all of us on a beautiful journey where we actually embarked on genuine collaboration, and there was no competition, and there was no stone unturned or topic too hard to discuss. You were really encouraging of us to kind of push towards those vulnerable and hard to have conversations. And I came away thinking, wow, you have an incredible capacity to use your language and use your manner with individual humans to really build us. How do others learn from that? Like, what are those skills that you've nurtured and that you've kind of highlighted in your own world that allow others to be that as well?
Oh, thanks, Jane. That was really generous. Thank you.
You did it beautifully. It could have been very different. We're a big group of very strong-minded individuals, and you really navigated us all incredibly well. And there were so many of us.
Yeah, no, it's fun. Look, I have been blessed to work around some pretty, really cranking good facilitators and people workers, and I think there's also a lot of practice there in activists and community kind of building and work situations as well. The thing that's been most helpful for my personal brain is to remember that it's not about me, it's about the people in the room. And that really helps me just step back and just facilitate whatever's happening in front of me, and to get where we need to go or get the outcomes that I think the group is looking to get. That's probably been a really empowering thing for me, especially as somebody who I don't particularly enjoy doing, I don't seek out to be in the front of 200 people. however, it comes back to that thing, it's like, get used to be uncomfortable, whether that's building community, facilitating a farmer gathering or climate action. We need to be uncomfortable to be our best selves and to kind of better the world around us. And I think people often assume that I'm an extrovert, that I'm just, you know, the life of the party. I won't even go to the parties, gosh.
I said yes and then didn't show up.
Yeah, oh, that's me. but I have had to do so much inner talking to my brain and my heart, just go, Hannah, have a crack. What's the worst thing that can happen? It's not that bad. And force myself. I even to start teaching permaculture, that was a horrifying experience.
Mm-hmm. Horrifying. And the expert in the front of the room.
Oh, so many tears. Like, oh gosh, awful. I'm much better these days, but still, like, it's I still have to prepare my brain to hold that space for that, you know, 1 or 14 days, whatever it is.
For 1 or 14 people. So it's a really complex thing to unravel.
Yeah, it's a lot of things. A lot of things I do which are not a natural thing for me to do, but I think it's worthwhile because it helps people. Yeah.
Does this tie into leadership and our lack of political leadership and as individuals, us trying to be there for our community and be better role models and just live our beliefs in that way when the pollies are letting us all down slightly?
Yeah. Look, definitely. So I mentioned the last federal election, which was just gut-wrenching results for us. We were just not okay. and we, Anton, my partner and I, we regrouped and went, what else can we do in our work? And that's why he and two friends started the electric car business, the Good Car Company. I am going deeper into community resilience work in our region, as well as keeping going everything else that we already do. And speaking up at every opportunity about the climate crisis or about community resilience is just, I used to censor myself a lot. I don't do that anymore because we don't have time for that kind of niceties, and I'm not so worried about upsetting people or making them feel uncomfortable. I'm also very good at delivering information with a big smile on my face. And so,
yeah. And using language that is gentle and encompassing, yeah, and accepting. Yeah.
Yeah. Because people are not inherently bad, and judgment is not a good technique of approaching people. And you know, we are more alike than we think, I reckon. Yeah.
Yeah.
And how do we reach the others? This is a conversation I have with my partner all the time, and people who, yeah, are passionate, you know, as we are, how do we go about having difficult conversations or non-existent conversations with other people who aren't like us, people who have different beliefs, who might be stuck in some way of thinking, we know we're not right, they're, you know, we have to acknowledge the nuances and complexities of humans and our beautiful differences, but how do we reach people shopping at Moles and Bullies, as Holmgren likes to call them?
Look, I'm okay with not talking to people who don't want to hear stuff. Growing up, I mentioned earlier, I was quite a dogmatic activist, and I would just talk at people until I'd wear them down, and it wasn't, it's not a great thing. And somewhere along the line, I just went, I'm not going to talk to people until they want to hear it. Yeah. And the other thought I had was, I'm just going to go demonstrate how people can live, and then support people who want to live that way to do the same through education and design services. And then when those people are ready, I will happily talk to them and, you know, help them out whenever which way.
Mm-hmm. Support them on their learning path.
Yeah. The other thing that I've done to my brain is just, I don't really care where people shop. Like, I'd care, but I don't, I'm like, cool, that's what you're doing right now. That must be working for you. I love you. Good on you. And there's a space of acceptance, and then a space of welcoming people into your life, even if they're not like you. I'm not being very articulate about it, but this is me trying to open myself to anybody and everybody. And in my experience with personal family members, when I've had that kind of openness, that's when they've started asking me about life-changing things, whether that's growing food or what's a composting toilet again, Hannah, and how do I build one? Where's my local food, whole food shop that I could go to? Or how do I shop without a plastic bag? Like, these are the kinds of questions that people have started asking me when I've just kind of given them a bit more unconditional love.
And backed off a bit on the dogmatics.
Yeah.
Yeah. And offline relationships too, because our neighbours and our family, they're not necessarily in our algorithms, they're not being coughed up by Instagram as like us. Mm-hmm. So we are able to have these more broad spectrum friendships and relationships out there in the real world. So I really love that loving approach that you have.
Yeah, we just need more love and more kindness, more joy, like, because this is tough work. It's, you know, it's long work. It's like, how do we find the joy in it? Because otherwise, what's the point of being here? I don't want to be serious and sad all the time.
Yeah. You've got to find things to really cheer about, don't you?
Yeah.
And there is plenty. I mean, I know it's pretty overwhelming out there if you really think hard about it and get yourself locked in kind of reading, but there's so much to be joyful about.
Yeah. And just the rich relationships that you make along the way is so special. I just so grateful for that. Like those big, deep conversations that you have with people around the world, and how you're planning to recreate systems and do things differently. It's really exciting stuff. Yeah.
We're in a really exciting time, aren't we?
Yeah, you're connecting more deeply perhaps with people than you would otherwise, because you're really digging around, searching for other ways of being. Yeah.
So, Hannah, you're essentially urban farming. So you're in Hobart, South Hobart. Katie is in the city as well, and Katie's experiences with future steading are quite different to mine, because I'm in northeast Victoria. What are some of those little things that you do that are really accessible that anyone who's in a city suburban block could start to do as part of their transition?
Yeah, look, We do, like, we do lots of things on our property, obviously. So we happen to have a large garden, so we grow fruit and veggies and have animals as well. But you can do that on a micro scale as well, whether it's on a balcony or a courtyard. There's lots of things and different methods and strategies available to you. We do lots of things beyond our fence line, which is why I love living in a city, which involves, like, we don't have a car, which is the best thing.
You have a bike, don't you?
Yeah, we've got heaps of bikes. So we happen to have two electric bikes, which we can get around the Hobart Hills on with our daughter on the back, which is really great. And we have a car share with some friends around the corner for when we need to use it for work or play. And that kind of resource sharing is really easy in the city. I share the vacuum cleaner with my next door neighbour.
Oh, that's so cool.
This stuff brings me so much joy. you know, and we do little things like at the beginning of COVID, when people were really freaking out and there's no fresh food in the shops, we set up a little fresh food stand outside another friend's house down the road where we can just dump surplus carrots, greens, eggs, and everybody does it now, seedlings, seeds, and that stuff, that, you know, sharing is really, it's easy in the city because we're all so close to each other and there's so many resources just lying around underutilized. And that's just one thing which I think cities have huge potential to just burst into life and just by connecting more and doing stuff. So I think that there's huge opportunity. One thing I'll point out, which we haven't mentioned, is composting. Even if you're not growing food, you can do a little bit of composting in your garden or your balcony with worm farms or compost bins. And getting food waste out of landfill, which is hugely problematic with the methane gases released into the atmosphere, which is a big contributor to climate change. So, you know, there's these simple tiny actions which, if we collectivise, are significantly powerful. Yeah,
And they all start to join the dots, because someone who's more concerned around, you know, First Nations justice, and someone who's more concerned around plastic-free existence, and someone who's more concerned around animal welfare, you all kind of start to come together, because the lens that you place over your actions are slightly different, but when we come together, it's really powerful.
Yeah, absolutely, because we need people focusing on all those different areas you've mentioned, and we need to have those intersections, so that, because there's lots of crossovers, so that our work is aligned and heading in the same direction. Yeah.
Are there any books or resources or tangents that are taking your attention at the moment, Hannah? Like, what are you into right now?
Oh, so I do have a stack of books in my bed which I haven't read, but I'm going to get there.
Dream. It's the dream. You'll do that at 3 in the morning.
Oh, gosh.
You
start your day. The books that are coming to my brain right now that I've read this year, there's one called From What Is to What If by Rob Hopkins. Some people may have heard of him. He founded the Transition Network movement along with others, and it's also trained in permaculture, etc. It's a really great book about imagination and about how we can imagine the world that we'd like to live in, and that how that's a critical step to then creating that world. So in the context of the climate crisis, it's a wonderful read. And especially as an activist or just any kind of change maker, it's a really important tool we might not value enough, the good old imagination.
And his language is soothing.
Yeah.
He sort of has this nurturingness about him that makes you think, yeah, okay, if I can just escape to my imagination, it will be okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and then act from that as well.
Yes.
Which is good. And I think you can put that lens onto all the big things in our world right now, whether that's around racism, First Nations justice, climate crisis, land management. You can use imagination is key in all those things. So I really like those frameworks that I can transfer to different areas. Yeah.
Yeah, good recommendation. Any anything you're listening to?
Oh. Like, lots of good Australian music. Do you know, interestingly, I go through patches, which I'm definitely in a patch now where I won't read much or listen to much around politics, climate, permaculture. I hardly ever read about permaculture or listen to anything about permaculture. Not because I don't love it, obviously. I think my brain has a level of fatigue, especially around climate doom and gloom. I pay attention. I'm not bagging out. I pay attention to news and any new science coming through. But I won't dwell on it. I won't dwell on the problems. I will only dwell on the solutions. And that's part of my coping systems to keep my anxiety in check and to keep me focused and moving forward. So right now, podcasts I've been listening to lately, I think there's like a really good murder mystery one. some really, you know, some great escapism and some amazing, I listen to heaps of music, which is, you know, I've been listening to lots of Thelma Plum, an incredible First Nations woman, musician, and Mama Kin and Briggs, who's also another great First Nations man, awesome. Like, so I'm really into music right now because I find that soothing and relaxing.
I love it. It's really important to remember not to saturate our brains with the earnest.
Yeah, I just tap out. I just go, you know what? I have to focus my energy on the solutions right now and but always pay attention to what's happening. Yeah.
Yeah, there's definitely a compost analogy in here somewhere where you need like a certain amount of each thing in a specific ratio, like information in, action to it, you know, so it can all ferment properly. Because I find that too, it's just an overwhelming amount of things to consume. You know, like I'll have 17 tabs open with articles that I need to get to, or people who I love who've done something that I need to appreciate. And it's just like only so much time that you have in the day, and you actually do need to act as well as pontificate and philosophize. And
I know
it's interesting to hear how you strike that balance, and it's great to hear that you have that creative outlet and the things that we don't really value as like, oh, this isn't a money-making endeavor, or you know, you obviously have those parts of your day as well.
Yeah, I just think also I've been thinking about this stuff for maybe 23 years, and I just I've got to be careful because I want to do this forever. And in that 23 years, the science actually hasn't changed. And so I'm like, oh, it's a new science report. I'll read the intro. Oh, nothing's changed. Okay, great.
Business as usual. Keep going.
Yeah. And the solutions, like there's been, you know, more, you know, I'm interested in any new solutions that might come up, but at the base, like we're still talking about solutions that we were talking about decades and decades ago. There's better communication and better access to some of that information now, which is great. And there's definitely new things we should always be aware of, especially around renewable energy. So that obviously pay attention and also just crack on with it. Just start doing stuff.
That doing bit seems to be a really strong theme that comes through all of our interviews. People say, God. I pontificate and I absorb knowledge and I kind of get my head clear on who I am and what I want. But then until I start doing, I feel overwhelmed. But once I start doing, that overwhelm dissipates and I feel like I'm contributing where I need to be.
Oh, totally. Oh, you know, the funniest story, I have a lovely friend who's a bit younger than me, and she helps me in the garden sometimes. She's like, Hannah, I stuffed up. I pruned my plum tree the wrong way. And I pruned it in winter and you meant to prune them in summer. I was like, oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I'm, you know, I'm on garden really? In Australia and I prune my plum tree in winter every year. And I'm like, she's like, you know, I read it in a textbook. I'm like, oh, don't worry about it. Like,
I'm like, the world went in.
Like, I think but this darling friend, she, I think there is a tendency for analysis paralysis where you analyze so much that you get to the point where you don't know what to do. And I just try, and, you know, my plum tree's really healthy and it's fine.
Even though you do prune it in winter.
Yeah, it's like the most productive tree we have.
Keep doing whatever it is you're doing wrong.
So I think the analogy I'm trying to draw on there is like, it's okay to fumble along and learn as you go. You're definitely going to make mistakes. But through doing, you're having a better impact than not doing anything. That's key thing. Yeah.
Yeah. It might be a little bit too big for the last 2 minutes of our conversation, but how do you know when you are pushing in the right direction? Because I know there's been really great books, you know, critiquing social enterprises or, you know, philanthropic things that go ahead and try and make the world a better place, but actually they're just screwing things up monumentally. And maybe when we keep it on a human scale, the answer is you can't really go that wrong. But how do you know you're doing the right thing?
Oh, look, I think about this so much. It's a big question. If we're going to look at, you know, the bigger picture of activism, it hasn't worked. We have failed in terms of addressing climate change. That's a really big sobering thought. So, you know, bugger. but there is, I think there are many. Sorry. Oh, there's a but there. But I think I think there's huge, huge promising work in that positive culture shifting narrative that we're seeing more and more of through storytelling, through experience sharing, and through inspiring leadership as well. And that is wonderful to see. And I think that is where the traction is coming. Whereas I think this is a blanket statement, but historically activism has been quite science and factually based, as you know, as it should be, but yeah. It's not necessarily engaging the people and bringing the people along with them,
shifting that needle.
Yeah, so that's what I think we're seeing now. Personally, I know when I'm on the track, I learned this new term recently called Shen, which is a Chinese medicine term around heart energy, and I'm like, oh, that's what it is. When you your heart feels really happy and tingly. And you just feel like inspiration is like shooting out of your head. That's like the Shen energy. Wow. And like I feel, yeah. And when I feel that, I'm like, yeah, this is what I need to do more of, that thing, or that's where I can offer more. Cause I've got lots of energy for that thing. That's been a good learning for me, listening to my body more and not just my brain. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That is a beautiful way to end. I'm going to go and follow my Shen and get in the garden. Katie, what are you doing to follow your Shen?
My Shen. Well, I might eat something. I'll follow my Shen to the fridge.
Hannah, it has been so lovely to talk to you. I have admired you from a distance for a very long time.
Oh, thank you so much, Jade and Katie.
Are you totally in love with Hannah? We're totally in love with Hannah. She's bloody awesome. If you need more of her in your life, you can find her and Anton and Frida at goodlifepermaculture.com.au, also on Instagram and also on YouTube. She has heaps of really amazing videos, so be sure to devour all the Hannah Maloney content that you can. We'd also like to try something a little new for season two in sharing your stories at the end of each episode to create more of a community vibe on the pod. Maybe you've grown your first backyard crop or had a hard but rewarding conversation with a family member, undergone a career transition, taken up a radical homesteading experiment, been part of a neighbourhood project that deserves applause, or simply had a lightbulb moment about living like tomorrow matters. We'd love to hear it and give you a shout out so that others can draw inspiration from what you're up to. You can talk to us on Instagram at futuresteading and with your permission, share your story with our listeners. We'd really love that, so feel free to get in touch. Meanwhile, we'll be back next Monday, same time, with another chewy and delicious conversation. See you then.